Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. Let us help you escape your mind.
Folks, welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. We have episode number 225 today. We're going to be discussing psychedelics and philosophy. We are joined by our guest, Sam Wolf. Sam is a journalist and a blogger, and we'll get into that in a second. Before we get started, if you want to head on over to his website, I have the link down below the video. It has all of his articles and anything he's done on there, so go check that out. Also, if you're interested, head on over to our Patreon at patreon.com/mindescapepodcast. For just $2 a month, you'll get exclusive guest episodes and segments. We're also on Discord. There's a ton of stuff up on Patreon. Even though we took a month and a half hiatus from live episodes, I've been posting episodes once a week, and there's a bunch of new Patreons on there, so go check that out. Thank you to all of our Patreon members. We love you and we appreciate it. And I know that last month and a half since we weren't doing live shows got a little thin there, but we'll get it going again here now. And one more thing, head on over to indrasweb.org. This is a social media platform we created to connect open minds. So if you want to hypothesize, theorize, speculate on all the topics we discuss, it's the perfect place to do it. Go set up an account. Still working on trying to get that in the App Store. And then we have a winner of our t-shirt contest. The winner is Cole. Congratulations, Cole. Honorable mention, Abner. We had a few other people that submitted, but we still have 2 shirts left. I think we have a medium and a large. So if anybody's interested, we're going to do the contest again. So all you have to do is go to Apple Podcasts, go to Mind Escape. I have the link down below. Leave us a 5-star review. Take a screenshot of it, send it to mindescapepodcast@gmail.com, and I will enter you to win. Again, there is a medium and a large left if anybody's interested in submitting that. So, I just want to say thank you to everybody. We did have our son about a month ago. He's a beautiful baby, and that's why we were on a little bit of a hiatus from doing live shows, but I appreciate all the support and the nice messages from everybody and everything. So we love everybody and we're glad to be back. And shout out to my amazing, beautiful wife, Amanda, who's taking care of him right now while I do this podcast. So thank you.
If you hear a little crying, then it's just back here.
Yeah, he should be okay. But welcome on the show, Sam. I know, I've been following your stuff for a little bit, and, I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
I think I was first introduced to your stuff like 3 or 4 years ago. You wrote an article about DMT jesters or entities, and I kind of referenced it in one of our episodes, and I think Maurice made a clip of it. But yeah, I was just... at the time, I thought it was interesting because everybody was like going to the most... woo-woo they could go to with the whole experience of that, and I thought you had a more reasonable take. Not that you'd said that those things weren't possible, but just that it doesn't really matter because you're having the experience and it's there, it's real to the person having it. So why don't you talk a little bit about that actually before, you know, before we get into some of the other aspects of, like I said, we're going to talk about food of the gods and stuff like that. So.
Sure. And thank you. I appreciate the words about my article. That's a nice compliment. I wrote the DMT Jester article because these particular type of entities, they seem to be really common in DMT experiences. Like they keep cropping up. Like I've seen them a lot and other people have seen them a lot and they just keep getting reported on. And they're kind of really strange entities. They're like, you know, even Rick Strassman, a lot of his participants reported seeing them, jesters, clowns, these types of beings. And I was kind of wondering, okay, what are they? Like, what actually are they? Like, what do they mean? Where do they come from? And I mean, there's so many different avenues you can go towards, like analyzing not only DMT jesters, but any DMT entity or any psychedelic entity in general. But I've always been interested in psychology and evolutionary theory. So I was interested in those particular angles on these entities. So I think it's actually quite easy to look at the DMT jesters from the Jungian perspective. They would fall under the broad category of trickster, the trickster archetype. And this is a reoccurring image or theme that you see in cultures and mythologies, you know, all around the world. The trickster, you see it in Inuit mythology as Raven, the trickster god, creator. You see it in South African mythology as Kagan. You see it in Middle Eastern mythology as Nasruddin. And then you have Loki from Norse mythology. And the list goes on.
Native American, the Lakota people, is it the Hayoka or the there's quite a few of them out there, and you're right, it's kind of like one of the, it's almost like the flood myth, right? You find it throughout different parts of the world, throughout history. It's kind of just like this archetype.
Exactly. Yeah, you have the flood myth in the Epic of Gilgamesh, and then it's since become one of, you know, the most iconic stories in the Bible. So there are definitely these motifs and themes and characters that reoccur throughout time and distance. And that's really interesting to me. And that was kind of the angle that I wanted to look at DMT jesters from. And so I started to look into what are the characteristics of jesters and tricksters. And generally in myths and cultures, jesters are there to lift up people's spirits. They're there to play pranks. They generate laughter and happiness, and they also like reverse the order of things. They kind of play with people's expectations. So there's a lot of like comedy in what they do. There's a lot of like breaking society's rules and kind of what you think is acceptable. And even in history, there were always these times like during Lent in medieval Europe, there were certain festivals like called the Feast of Fools. That was a particular time that people were kind of allowed to let loose before Lent, when you had to fast. And this was like a particular time when you're kind of allowed to be silly and get drunk and dance and sing and play jokes. And so that seems like a human need to me, like the human need to have that kind of aspect of life. And we see it in, as I say, like in all these stories, this is the trickster or the jester reoccurring. And I think that's a reflection of that need. And to tie that into the DMT experience, I think the reason people see jesters and tricksters so often is because of that human need. It's like the entities are showing you what you need, like what you need to become, or an aspect of yourself that you should try and integrate. I think that's why the jesters are so common. It's like life could be so much more fun if you were just a bit more like this, a bit more playful, a bit more jokey, a bit less serious.
Right. Mm. I think you hit it on there, but I also think that, I don't know. I wonder about the jester archetype or the trickster, is if it's almost like, you know, you mentioned, I think like subconscious, and this is something we've talked a lot about on the show. Is it something external or is it something internal that's manifesting itself through this experience? to try and get some message through to yourself, because maybe, you know, you're so stuck in day-to-day consciousness, or your mind knows itself somehow in that way where this is the way it's going to get through. I find that aspect of it most interesting to me, is that, is it ourselves or is it external? Because if it is external, I mean, that has a lot of implications for, you know, you could go throughout history and a lot of things would make sense, right? You know, gods and demigods and, as you mentioned, a lot of the archetypal stuff. I mean, for me, when I've had psychedelic experiences with entities, it feels external, but at the same time, it's not something where you feel like you're having a conversation, or, you know, you could reach out and touch whatever it is, if that makes sense. It's almost like a hologram in a way. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, do you have any experience with these, like, firsthand, or is this just something that you're interested in?
First-hand experience with entities, you mean?
Or like psychedelic entities, or is this, you know, like, I know you're writing about, you don't have to say if you don't want to, obviously. I mean, I know there's a lot of people that, you know, it's kind of a taboo thing, but yeah, I mean, I was just curious if you have had any of these experiences, or is this just something that interests you that you write about?
I mean, it's both.
Okay.
I wanted to write the article because of just how prevalent the jester archetype was in my experiences. Those experiences were just really profound and meaningful, and it kind of influenced a lot of the drawings I did, because I'm quite into art as well. So I would often like draw,
okay,
not really thinking about it, but drawing jester type entities. So they were definitely an aspect of the experience that was, you know, it left like a strong impression on me.
Sure.
So my feeling about them is probably what's reflected in the article. I do think they're an aspect of myself, which is showing up in the experience. I guess you could call it a projection in some way, or something like that. And that's not in any way to diminish the meaning of the jesters or how profound the experience is. I think they're like profoundly important experiences in terms of, you know, trying to integrate the kind of meaning of these archetypes. I guess I've wrestled with the question of, you know, could they be external? Could they be independent of my mind? And it's definitely a possibility. Like, I'm not closed off to that being possible. I mean, it could be a human tendency to perceive jesters, and these archetypes could also be actual, you know, discarnate external entities.
Sure.
But I think it would have to pass a certain test to prove that it was an external entity. And one of those could be, do these entities say anything to you? Do they deliver any message that you couldn't have otherwise got from yourself? And I haven't yet seen an example of a message that an entity has relayed to someone that they couldn't have known otherwise. So,
right. I mean, yeah, it's not like a psychic, right, telling you about somebody that you knew that passed away that has some special message or something that they would only know. It's not like that. I get what you're saying. But in one sense, though, there's like some sort of like transcendent wisdom that does get passed down to some people. From talking to all the people we have on the podcast, scientists, experiencers, people that just do it recreationally, it seems like, obviously, ayahuasca, you can work with it. There's more of an interaction there. And smoking it or whatever, injecting it's more of just complete blast off. And it seems like it's very hard. You experience things, you get messages, but it's very hard to, you know, be in it for a long time. But that's why I think they're doing those DMTX experiments and the extended state experiments. And I think that if something can be taken from that, we'll figure out kind of what you're saying. Is there some sort of message? Is this some sort of random thing that's happening? I think it's weird, though, if it is random, that people see this specific thing that gives them this random message. I actually, you know, I equated it to like, you're on the internet, you're searching, and you hit like a wrong page, and it brings up like the gear, or like, you know, on YouTube sometimes it's like a little monkey holding a wrench, you know, over its shoulder, something like that. It's like playing, you know, it's like you've reached the edge of reality or whatever, and you know, we're working on it, kind of a thing. That's kind of how I've perceived it sometimes from what people have described. But again, just my own experiences with entities and high dose, you know, psychedelics has been, it again, it does feel like a hologram in a way. It feels like it's there, but it's not like a solid physical thing. But yeah, I don't know. It's very bizarre. But I recommend everybody go read your article on it, because I thought what I like is you're able to entertain these ideas without going full in on them, if that makes sense, you know.
Sure.
What is it? Aristotle said it's the mark of intelligence to be able to entertain an idea without fully believing it, or something along those lines. So that's kind of my philosophy on these kinds of things too. Like, let's talk about it, let's entertain it, but we don't always have to believe everything, right?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I'm definitely not against speculation. And I think one of the great things about psychedelics is that they open you up to so much speculation. But as you say, you don't want to kind of be so open-minded that your brain falls out, as the saying goes.
Right.
You want to be able to entertain ideas without jumping on the first one that sounds the most fantastical and kind of fun to believe in.
And it is fun. I mean, when I first heard about these entities, Maurice and I had like, you know, 20 years of psychedelic experiences, but we never experienced DMT. So it's like, I mean, we kind of knew about it. We, you know, grew up around, you know, hippie culture and jam bands and stuff like that. So we're aware of what it is and everything. But it just, in terms of when we first read those reports and people blogging about it and writing articles and all this stuff, it just really kind of piqued my interest. Number one, we do all have dimethyltryptamine produced in our bodies. And two, we're into weird things. So I thought that was just a bizarre thing that nobody can explain. And I like things like that, because I feel like that's, you know, that's the edge of science right there. You know, that's the next step of whatever we're going to figure out, whether it's the mind or consciousness or whatever. So,
well, yeah, it also makes you kind of wonder, what do we already know? Because we've heard these reports of people going into comas and then waking up and learning how to like speak a different language and stuff like that. So maybe we do know all, and we just need to unlock these certain different things within us. And maybe these substances can help us unlock that knowledge that we already possess.
Yeah. I mean, that would kind of be my feeling about it at the moment, that these psychedelics do reduce barriers between the unconscious and conscious, and the unconscious contains like just a wellspring of wisdom and teachings. And I think that psychedelics, they kind of just break down that barrier, and it opens us up to things that we don't think about, and probably we can't think about, because if we thought about everything at once, it would be just too overwhelming. So there has to be some barrier involved.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the other aspect of it too. It's almost like, I mean, psychedelics in general, but anything like a concentrated salvia or concentrated DMT, it seems to just remove the pareidolia that's been built into our evolutionary brains and minds, and then we're seeing kind of everything at once, and maybe that's the overwhelming aspect of it, right? So I think that that's where a lot of people get the idea that maybe they are external, because if you're able to remove these filters that we have built into ourselves or our minds, that maybe there is other things beyond that. And I think that, you know, that's where a lot of people, I think, get that idea. And it's not that crazy of an idea. And I think that, like I said, it'll be interesting to see what science does, because even though a lot of people that believe a lot of those things don't want to talk about science, or it's like, they can't verify or negate my experience, at the same time, I think it is important to try and understand as much as we can. So,
yeah, definitely. And I think, from a scientific perspective, I find the evolutionary perspective on entities really interesting. I was reading this paper by a researcher called Michael Winkelmann. He used to teach human evolution at Arizona State University. He wrote a paper in 2018 trying to look at entities from this kind of evolutionary angle. And he talked about kind of the common cognitive mechanisms that humans have that make them kind of primed to either see or believe in entities. So some of these mechanisms are like agency detection, which is the human bias to detect agents or agency in the natural world or natural events when there aren't any. And so something like that is because if you didn't have that bias, you would be less likely to survive. So the cost of believing that there's agents when there aren't any is small compared to the cost of not believing there's agents mm-hmm. when, you know, one time out of 1,000, there could be a lion behind a bush. And if you don't mistake it every time for a lion, you know, you're less likely to survive than someone who, just thinks it's a twig breaking in the bush.
Yeah, it's almost like Pascal's wager, but with nature instead of God.
That's it. That's it, exactly. Yeah, Pascal's wager. And so there's that, and then we have biases like anthropomorphism. We have a tendency to project human characteristics onto, like, patterns and the natural world. We have a tendency to read, called mind reading or theory of mind. So we try to kind of gauge the intentions and desires and goals of other people, but we end up projecting that into everything because, again, it's like Pascal's wager. You're more likely to survive if you do that incorrectly than if you don't. And the cost of doing it incorrectly isn't that big compared to the cost of, you know, not knowing whether a human is being deceptive towards you or not. And that kind of stuff. So
yeah,
there are these kind of biases that kind of make us prone to detect entities or kind of agents when there aren't in fact any.
Yeah. And I think you hit it on the head too with we have built-in pareidolia. Like, we're designed to pick up patterns or put things together. I mean, if anybody's sitting outside looking up at the clouds on a beautiful day, you're going to try and, like, what does that cloud look like? You know, oh, it looks like a dog, or it looks like a person, mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever. So we do that with everything. And I think that that's the only thing that, you know, when we think about all these more esoteric or out there ideas, that's the only thing that holds me back a little bit, is just knowing that about ourselves, because is that happening in those states too? You know what I'm saying? Like, is that just doing that on a crazy level that we already do that. So is psychedelics just magnifying that times 1,000 or whatever the case may be?
Yeah. I mean, that's, so that researcher Winkelmann, that's kind of his position in this paper. He says, psychedelics basically activate these cognitive mechanisms. I don't know why. I mean, it feels like incredibly meaningful when these experiences happen. But he thinks the entities are basically an activation of these kind of inbuilt tendencies we have.
Yeah, and like, look, on this podcast, I think over the years we've really changed our opinions. We've gone from the craziest of the woo stuff to actually doing research and reading books and cross-referencing and talking to different people and having more personal experience. And I think that, you know, when we say these things, I think people want to hear the craziest thing, right? Like, that's the most lucrative thing, is for us to just sit here and say, oh, they're external and they're giving us these messages, but that's not mm-hmm. truth, and that's not my truth. I know that's not Maurice's truth. I'm sure that's not your truth. So the truth isn't as always as sexy sometimes, right? It's a tough road. It's a lonely road. And I think that stuff like this, I want the truth, so I'm going to be as honest with myself as possible. And I don't know, lately I've been posting things on, like, Twitter, like, just be honest with yourself. Like, why do you believe things that you believe, things like that? And I think people would agree with that to a certain extent, but we all do that. We all tell ourselves these lies or trick ourselves, you know? So that's why when we talk about tricksters, we're already doing that to ourselves in day-to-day consciousness to a certain level, right? For that to come out in a psychedelic experience, again, I'm not saying these things couldn't be external or they're not something weirder or esoteric or deeper. I'm just saying that for me, I like to entertain all ideas. Like we were talking about the Aristotle quote. I like to, you know, I don't have to believe something to at least bring it into the mix and weigh it against everything else. So.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry Chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Yeah, and I guess I would like to say that even like, I mean, you can apply these perspectives, the scientific perspective, and you can be as skeptical as you like, but that, for me, that doesn't change how incredibly insane like a DMT breakthrough experience is. Like, I mean, and also these perspectives don't fully explain the experience. Like, I can know about, you know, these human biases to detect agents, and that makes me like, that makes me prone to see spirits and entities, but that doesn't fully experience the meaning of the experience. It doesn't explain just so many aspects of it. And so that, I mean, that, that level is kind of just one level amongst many. I mean, there's psychological aspects, there's philosophical, there's, you can take a therapeutic aspect, like how can I apply this to my life, like to actually improve things. So it's just one angle amongst many, I think.
Well, and you bring up something interesting there, because it's like, we've talked about my OCD on the podcast a million times, and the use, my use of psilocybin to kind of reset myself occasionally and allow myself to take on, you know, CBT therapy or things like that. When you look at what you just said, though, I think for me, it's when I see people posting about all this psychedelic therapy and all this stuff, obviously we like it. We like to see all these different options out on the table. But at the same time, it's like the way that they're talking about it scientifically does not align with my personal experience, which would be the mystical experience was the thing that helped me. It wasn't necessarily just the compounds, because I've taken derivatives and isolated compounds of certain psychoactive compounds that are found naturally within plants and fungi and things. And it's not the same. I'm not saying that you need the whole thing, but I think, for instance, like a you know, a psilocybe mushroom or whatever, I think there is like a built-in entourage effect that I don't know if that can be replaced in a lab by just taking the isolated compound, you know, psilocybin or psilocin or whatever. So I know that there's an argument over 5-MeO. There's a lot of people that swear by Bufo, you know, the toad extractions. But then there, you know, you have that episode with Hamilton from Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia where he's describing, well, look, I've had these experiences and they're no different than, you know, the synthesized is no different than the, but that's different because I don't think that, you know, mushrooms do have a bunch of other compounds in it, just like cannabis. How many cannabinoids are in cannabis, or how many different chemicals are in cannabis? So I think that when I look at that stuff, it's interesting to see where the science is going, because I think that some of these things are already built in technologies with the experience to trail, you know, and I, like I said, I think that for me, the mystical was the thing that helped me. And I don't think that I see enough of that. I see them trying to get away from that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point about this entourage effect that you get from eating like the whole plant or the whole mushroom. Psilocybin mushrooms do have a lot of other compounds like baocysteine, which I think a lot of people compare it to CBD and cannabis. Like it acts synergistically with cannabis, but it actually helps to kind of take the edge off.
Right.
If that makes sense. So certain species that have higher levels of baocysteine might be easier experiences. I can't remember too much.
Yeah, I've
about
seen
that.
Actually a comparison now that you mentioned that, to cut you off. But what you're saying is like almost like cannabis, like I mentioned, like some of these other compounds are like similar to how CBD kind of balances you out with the THC in a way.
Right. Exactly.
And there was one other, I can't think of the, it's like a long name, but there was something they found in certain mushrooms that they feel like is that thing that balances. It's like the counterweight that gives you, most people that have experienced this type of mushroom with this specific compound, it's been like a positive experience, and they're trying to figure out like why that is versus the other experiences.
Yeah, that could actually be the one I'm thinking of. I think it begins with an A.
Yeah, yeah, that is a root, or I don't know.
Arugas, something
like that. I know what you're talking about. I always forget that name specifically, but we've talked about it. I've mentioned it in another one, our other episodes, but so what do you think in terms of the whole science versus mysticism? Like, do you think that there is going to be some sort of, you know, battle at some point? Because right now it seems like everybody's kind of just like habitating the space pretty, you know, everybody's been navigating it pretty easily from what I can understand. And I've asked a lot of people, like, how do you feel about science? How do you feel about the tech? How do you feel about, you know, the money aspect? Like, how do you feel about these things? And everybody seems to just be doing their own thing. Do you think at some point, though, all this will come to head and there will be some sort of mysticism versus science, or science versus money, or, you know, mysticism versus tech, or something along those lines?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I suppose we're already seeing those kind of conflicts. I mean, in some ways, the science has blended the mysticism purely because it uses these mysticism questionnaires that are kind of, that have been inherited from the 60s. So a lot of the language in these, you know, clinical trials is mystical. You know, they refer to the ineffable, the sacred, the noetic, like very mystical concepts. But, it has been, these are concepts that have been, you know, quantified. And, you know, can you capture the mystical within questionnaires? It's, you know, how do you capture the ineffable in a questionnaire? I don't really know. How do you rate the ineffable? It seems like a pretty tricky thing to do. But I think there will be these divergences. And when psilocybin is legalized for therapeutic use, you know, if they follow the model of the clinical trials, I suppose that's what will be established. But I guess, like with something like cannabis, it's first legalized, you know, for medical use, and then eventually legalized in a much broader context. And I think when that happens with psilocybin, there'll be all kinds of contexts in which you can take it. You know, there'll definitely be retreats. I mean, there are already psilocybin retreats in Jamaica and the Netherlands, and they definitely don't operate like according to the medical context. I mean, in some ways they're similar. I know that Rosalind Watts from Imperial College, she works with I think it's called Synthesis Retreats in the Netherlands, and she does try to bring the Imperial model, or like at least protocols from that model into the retreat to maximize the benefits. But still, I would say those retreat settings are pretty different from the medical context.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for people doing whatever they want. Maybe it's because I already have a history with these things dating back to my high school days, but I'm not a fan of the idea of a retreat. I'd rather just sit in darkness. You know, I don't need a bunch of people around me. I'm not saying I would never do it, but it's just not my thing. And I'm not against it. I just, you know, you have to do what works for you. I just think it's interesting that that's how some people are introduced to it. And I remember in high school just being around people that were my friends and thinking, like, this person's like an alien to me. Who is this person? Why am I even friends with this person? You know what I'm saying? So it's like, I can't even imagine that with a complete stranger. So,
yeah, I mean, it's such like an intimate experience. And I've considered, like, you know, would I go to a mushroom retreat or an ayahuasca retreat? And the thing that puts me off the most is, you know, what are the other people going to be like? What if I don't vibe with them? What if I don't like the guides and I've already paid for the retreat and I get there,
right,
and they're talking to me about, you know, energy and chakras and I'm just not into it? Then that's just going to just like color the experience in a way that it just isn't helpful. So I'm probably with you on that. I would, at the moment, I kind of prefer to take them alone. If I'm looking for an experience that is therapeutic and uninterrupted and just the experience I want, then that's probably how I take them. But I mean, I would be open to them at some point. Like if I'd met the guides beforehand, maybe if it was a one-on-one session with a guide, or kind of I read like really good stuff about the retreat, then, you know, maybe I would consider it.
Yeah, it's almost like religion in a way. And I can equate that, obviously, religion to a few different things. But one of them being that, you know, the modern day scientist or shaman is just what the priest is. It's trying to connect you to this thing, but we can all connect to it, you know. And I think that the problem is the inexperience, right? Is people that don't know what to expect, or they don't know what they're doing in terms of dose and dosage and set and setting. And I think it's something that if you know what you're doing, you don't need that aspect of it, that conduit, if you will. But I mean, it's good to hit depending on what you do, because there's obviously ones that you need like a sitter, or it's super long, or given the context.
Yeah, they're doing them with therapists.
Right. Well, doing it with the context of the world and the way things are and things like that. But yeah, with the whole therapist thing, I'm not against it. I just think that, again, it's my most profound experiences have been me understanding myself and my mind, and then sitting in silent darkness on a high dose and processing things about myself and going through, almost like memories are even more vivid and more real than my actual memories, if that makes sense too. So it's things right. like that I think that are, you can dial in or aren't able to access that you wouldn't be at one of these retreats where you're, like you said, that your experience is being colored by your surroundings and the other people and worries that you wouldn't normally have if you were in the comfort of your own home or an office or something like that.
Exactly. I think it kind of just depends on your preferences and even like personality type. Like, I don't know, I'm kind of like more introverted. So if I had to spend like multiple days with people and like not have alone time, I don't know, maybe that would like just tire me out and I just wouldn't be up for talking like all the time. I just want to kind of be on my own. And
right.
Yeah, I don't know.
I agree with that.
Yeah, but we're a little more introduced to it. You know, if you have someone that's never done it before, it might be more appealing if they can go in with a therapist and stuff like that.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think it comes down to experience, is what I was saying. Like, if you have that experience, you don't need the shaman or the priest or the conduit or whatever this intermediary is. You can just access it, you know, and have a good experience. But what you're saying is true. I mean, like, look, you know, the first time you do it, you don't want to be alone. That's for sure. You want knowledgeable people around you. So again, I think that first time or first few times or things like that, you know, maybe it's not a bad idea, but having knowledgeable friends is just as good in that sense. But let's pivot a little bit. I do want to talk about your article that you wrote about Food of the Gods and Terence McKenna's Stoned Ape Theory. So in the article, again, it's one of those ones where you wrote where you entertained the idea, you thought there's interesting aspects of it, however, you're not all in on it, and there's other people that do back it up. I mean, Paul Stamets is, you know, pretty knowledgeable when it comes to mushrooms, and he kind of endorses the, let's call it a hypothesis, because that's what it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, what was your thinking on that, and where do you stand? You know, is it, do you still feel that way after writing the article, or how do you feel about it?
Yeah, so the article I wrote back in 2013, so 8 years ago.
Right.
And I did have a look at it. I had a look at it again. And yeah, I think there were good points. I would probably write it in a different way. It's kind of interesting to look back on my writing in the past. Like, I think I wouldn't be so, like, I point out a lot that McKenna uses, it's kind of based on speculation. But I feel like in the article, I was maybe a bit dismissive of that fact, because there's actually nothing wrong with speculation. And most of the most popular ideas in evolution are speculation. So there's nothing wrong with it from that point of view.
That's a whole different topic, though. That's like talking about science and science communicators and scientism,
right,
and why we feel ashamed to even speculate, right? So, but yeah. But yeah, I agree about looking back at things for sure. But so, so where do you stand now though? Do you think that there's something to it in general, or do you think that it's just maybe a piece of the puzzle or something like that?
Yeah, so I still, in the article, I do say the scenario that McKenna's describing is possible and perhaps even plausible. But it really depends on the kind of... So I should go back and I should kind of talk about the key points that McKenna raises in kind of explaining it. So the reason McKenna came up with it is because there's this massive mystery in evolution, which is how did the brain size double from 1.8 million years ago from the emergence of Homo erectus to modern day humans about 200,000 years ago? And it's something that is like really unusual. I mean, over a million years may sound like a long time, but in evolution, it's a pretty short time, and especially very short for a brain size of any animal to double in size. So there's a lot of like competing theories from scientists like to try and describe this. People point to the cooking of food. People point to the making and using of tools. People say the demands for complex social relationships explains this doubling.
New hunting techniques, I think, is one of them.
Hunting, eating omega-3 fatty acids from fish. So that's kind of more a dietary explanation. And I guess McKenna's is sort of a dietary explanation, except the thing that is being consumed is, you know, a psychedelic. And so he thought the consumption of psilocybin mushrooms on the African savannah was responsible, or could be responsible, for this doubling. And it would also be responsible for many other kind of distinctly human traits. So he pointed to religion, art, and language as three other traits that he thought the consumption of magic mushrooms could have engendered. So when I read Food of the Gods, which came out in 92, I loved the explanation, and it became one of these like favorite theories amongst kind of psychonauts and, you know, psychedelic enthusiasts. But I guess I was a bit skeptical, so I tried to find criticisms of the theory or hypothesis, and I came across an article called, I think it was called Concerning Terence McKenna's Stoned Apes, written by Brian Akers. So Akers is a writer and a researcher. He actually, just to give a bit of background about him, he wrote a paper in 2011 about these mushrooms that were depicted on a cave wall in Spain. It's kind of like
what's it? I have the image as my backdrop on here. It's Selva Pascuala or something like that, I think is the cave art, where it's got all the little psilocybe Mexicana, or not psilocybe Mexicana, let me pull it up.
I think it's psilocybe Hispanica.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. So he actually, that's the earliest sign we have of psychedelic use in Europe. So that was a pretty important paper. So that's kind of the work he's doing. He's like very interested in mushrooms. And so the article he wrote on McKenna's stoned ape hypothesis was pretty critical. And that's where I got a lot of the information about the studies that McKenna was referring to when he was trying to support his hypothesis. And that's where I got a lot of the kind of critiques from. So one of McKenna's key claims is that eating magic mushrooms would have benefited our ancestors because in low doses, it increases something called visual acuity or edge detection. And McKenna derived this idea from a 1970 paper by two scientists in which they gave participants psilocybin, and then they got them to look at these lines that were next to each other, and the lines were kind of a bit skewed, but they would turn, and then at some point they would become parallel. So they tested people on psilocybin and people sober, and they wanted to see who could detect first when the lines become parallel. But according to Akers, who wrote this critique, this was not a test for visual acuity. And the researchers didn't find that people who ate psilocybin were any better at kind of seeing stuff in the distance, which is what visual acuity is. And actually, these two scientists wrote a later paper in 73, where one of the authors actually said that, I think this is a quote, he said, psilocybin may not be conducive to the survival of an organism. So this was a later study with psilocybin, and he found the perceptual changes weren't actually beneficial for survival. So that's one of McKenna's key claims. And he also claims that these two scientists gave participants low doses of psilocybin, but they actually gave them medium doses. So the idea that low dose will help with visual acuity hasn't yet been established, from what I know. Although I'm sure a test could be done. That would actually be quite interesting to see, like, if you gave people psilocybin, one group psilocybin, another group placebo, and you got them to see, like, you know, when you go to an optician, they test, like, how clearly can you see these letters in the distance. It would be interesting to see, you know, if the psilocybin people would perform, you know, better on the drug compared to not.
What I would say is, you're obviously more aware of patterns in general and things moving. As you know, I'm sure you know, if you've had that experience, everything flows, right? So like, if you look at like a carpet, the pattern's going to flow. If you look at, you know, the wall, you know, maybe you'll see more of that popcorn pop out at you. So I think it does enhance something. I can't say whether that's visual acuity or not, but it does make you, I think, more aware, if that makes sense, of your visual space and maybe things that, like, patterns and things you wouldn't have recognized before. So,
yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I've experienced that. And I think most people, like, who have tried psychedelics, they'll say, you know, the edges are extremely clear and defined. Whether that actually translates into like a placebo controlled study, we don't yet know.
Right.
I mean, it definitely could, and I'm open to that. And then if a low dose does increase visual acuity, that would add a bit more support for McKenna's hypothesis.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I think my personal take on it, and we can keep talking about all the other aspects if you want. And I think he even pointed to what he uses, that image from that cave in Algeria, which is the oldest. The one you mentioned in Spain, Selva, is, I think, the second oldest. The oldest one is actually from Algeria. I think it's like 9,000 years old or something like that. Mm. And it's a shaman with like a bee face holding, you know, mushrooms in each hand. Yeah. But so in terms of where I think he missed the mark is, if you want to talk about like the physical mechanisms behind evolution, that's interesting, I guess, you know, like if that being the cause. But I think something that he could have gone to that's far more, I think it's even more interesting and maybe even a lower hanging fruit, is this idea of like metaphysics and where did metaphysics come from? Because I don't know about you, but walking around in day-to-day consciousness, I don't see any gods. I don't see any mystical metaphysical beings. I don't really ponder life too much, you know, but psychedelics definitely bring that out. So it's like, I could see somebody maybe in prehistoric times or early, you know, civilization times ingesting some sort of entheogen and then starting to speculate, well, what is this? You know, there's got to be more going on here than meets the eye. So for me, it's like the stoned ape hypothesis could be real if you just more applied it to the mind and philosophy of the mind. And like, if you look at like religions and belief in metaphysical things and things beyond the scope of reality. And even looking at that, it's like, that could be some sort of evolutionary mechanism itself, like religion or belief in a higher power or whatever, because it's pushing you to like work towards something, right? You got to find out, you got to traverse the stars, you've got to, you know. So I find that more fascinating. And I think that if you would have maybe went in that direction, there would have been maybe less pushback. But I mean, when you get into the hard sciences and biology and anthropology and, you know, some of the more, ways that we analyze ancient people, then I think it gets a little bit more dicey because there's really not a ton of answers and it's hard to even test that. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really good point to bring up. I think, so McKenna did refer to the origins of religion as psychedelics leading to the origins of religion. And I mean, if our hominid ancestors did consume magic mushrooms at a high enough dose, I think, you know, they have pretty much the same brains. They could easily have a mystical experience, and they have no knowledge of anything else we have. And I think if you experience the divine with that kind of background, I think you're just going to believe it's in a divine other. Like, I don't really see how they would come to any other conclusion than to believe that this kind of presence or force that they experience would be anything except, you know, this presence or force. So then they would, and everything is based on their immediate experience. So I don't see how they would interpret it in any other way.
Right. Yeah, actually, I wrote a blog, kind of a similar thing about seeing UFOs and things, weird things in the sky, and equating it to like the Greek gods, how they were more real than real to the people living there. But we know now, you know, where are these gods? You know, they were just assigning, you know, I think Thales came along and kind of broke that. But for a while, you know, back in the days of Homer, people thought like, you know, Poseidon controlled the sea and Zeus controlled the sky. You know, like there was different elements there that were assigned to these gods. And I think that when you look at psychedelics, I think that it magnifies something in us to like want to believe. It's this mystical weird thing that happens that pushes us, you know, like we're dangling this carrot in front of ourselves if it happens to just be us. You know, if there's some external thing, like I said, I think that there's greater implications. That's why we should keep looking into these things. But I mean, I don't know. What do you think? Because I look at like the Eleusinian Mysteries. I look at Plato and Euclid and Pythagoras and like all these great minds. They all participated in this thing, and they, you know, like was the first, you know, did Euclid come up with all these geometric ideas from that experience, being able to see all these fractals and, you know, being able to visualize something that's not visual? Or Plato, you know, the allegory of the cave, there's that Platonian cave in Eleusis, you know, did he walk over there and have this like weird thought experiment? You know, I think about things like that, and I'm not saying that those happen for sure, but it is interesting to think about. And I think that the metaphysic aspects of it, I don't know if you think about that, but I just think that psychedelics were probably, or altered states in general, I guess it could be like lucid dreams or meditation or whatever, but just that's where the idea of metaphysics came from, because I don't see that coming into the spectrum in day-to-day consciousness. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I'd never even thought like whether Pythagoras and his you know, geometric shapes and everything might have been influenced by his, you know, taking part in the Eleusinian Mysteries. That's a pretty interesting take. But yeah, Plato's cave allegory, that has always seemed a kind of psychedelic idea. You know, are we perceiving the shadows, or are we perceiving reality behind the shadows? And that would also be interesting to kind of think about whether that was influenced by him taking part in these Eleusinian Mysteries.
Yeah, I mean, he spoke about it. He referenced it. So, I mean, we definitely know Socrates, you know, they're definitely referenced. So, but what do you think? I mean, you've had the experiences, you've written about this. Do you think that that's a possibility? Or do you think that, again, it's like the stoned ape where maybe it was a bunch of things coming together?
Well, I definitely think that if you take psychedelics, they can make you question fundamentally what you think reality is. So, and that's what metaphysics relates to, you know, what is the fundamental substance, you know, is there a duality or is it just one substance? Like psychedelics definitely do bring up those questions. And there was a paper, I think it was published this year or maybe last year, from the philosopher Derek Anderson and the psychologist David Yaden. They looked at what philosophers believe and certain experiences they've had. And the philosophers who've had past experience with psychedelics and cannabis, they were more likely to believe in idealism. So the idea that reality is composed of ideas, not material things.
Right.
So there is good evidence that psychedelics make you think about metaphysics differently, or at least there's that correlation. So,
No, I was just going to say, and I know the materialists and the dogmatic scientists will say, obviously, that all this is just a product of our brain. You know, our minds are a product of our brain, and we'll find that out in the future. There's no reason to get into all the woo-woo aspects of it. But what if they're wrong? What if the brain is some sort of like receiver, you know, of vibration and energy, and, you know, there's no way to figure that out because we can't crack the hard problem of consciousness. Even when they do those fMRI studies and stuff, there's like weird, wacky things. Like there's one from Duke where they put people through a bunch of functions and under the fMRI, and they came back and did the same thing, and all the brain functions that they used for the one thing were completely different, you know, different parts of the brain when they came back and redid that. So it's like, what's going on?
Wow.
Yeah, we may never know. That's
right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's just a lot of stuff that you can look at and look. There's a reason why we do our show. You know, we look at the mysteries of life, and some of them, you know, I feel like there's definitely some weird stuff out there to entertain, but then there's also things that can be explained. As you mentioned, you know, there's people doing actual science and not necessarily debunking it, but coming up with good evidence why this might be the case or that might be the case. One thing I will point out from being in this like alternative metaphysical community and entertaining some of these metaphysical ideas, one pet peeve is when, and we used to do this too, so I'm not exempt from this, you know, this is something I've worked on with my own biases, but using science to benefit you in your argument when it's something, you know, weird or mystical, but then being against the science that says something to the opposite of what you want it to say, right? So it's like using science when it's convenient and not using it omitting it when it's, you know, not. So that's one thing that bugs me that I learned about myself that I used to do. So, but yeah, it's just being honest with ourselves.
Yeah, I can relate to that a lot. I guess there's something kind of almost satisfying satisfying with being this kind of, or wanting to be this kind of skeptical scientific guy. And I do try and like be conscious of, you know, confirmation bias, like you were talking about, like only looking at what supports you and not what goes against. So yeah, it's important to have an open mind and not kind of just treat everything with extreme skepticism, like dismissing everything immediately as woo woo, because we just don't know. Like there's so much mystery. And like Maurice was saying, it could always be mystery. We might never know certain things, and it is difficult to kind of accept mystery and that it might be permanent, because we want answers. It's like much more comforting to have a solid answer or argument and then just forget about the debate. But there might be certain questions, like metaphysical questions, which there may never be an answer. It might always just be, well, it seems more likely it's this than this, or there's good arguments for and against, but there may never be a point at which we're like, yeah, the metaphysics is completely solved. There's no hard problem of consciousness. We know that it's materialism. Panpsychism is never going to work. Like, I think these are questions that we're always going to have to deal with.
Yeah. I definitely agree with that. I keep saying it. Science is like Sisyphus pushing the boulder up the side of the mountain. You know, like I don't think this is ever going to get settled. And I hate when somebody writes a book, or a scientist like writes a book like 30 years ago, and they're still like avidly defending it, even though the science has come out against, you know, that theory or hypothesis or whatever. So I'm against that and all, you know, I'm against that within the woo community when people are so dogmatic, they won't even look at science that produces, you know, an experiment that shows that this is capable or not capable, or, you know, whatever. And I hate when I see it from scientists too, that are like, oh, you know, we have to just isolate this compound from psychedelics because that'll help people. That's the thing that's helping people. Well, you know, are you discounting the mind, which you don't fully understand and may not ever stand, you know, understand? And I don't know how you feel about this though, but to the consciousness aspect and the hard problem of consciousness, I don't think we will ever figure it out, because I don't think, unless we're able to get outside of ourselves and our consciousness to crack that. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's one thing to look at like a dog or a cat and try and analyze them and figure out what's going on, and we still don't really understand fully other than instinctual stuff. But then it's a completely another, you know, another thing if you look at our impact on the world and even our place in the universe. To the only time people get great perspectives or something original or an original thought is when they do psychedelics or they do lucid dream or they do meditate or whatever. So I don't think there will ever be a time where science is going to be able to say, this is exactly what's happening. You don't have to think about this anymore because this is how it works, and that's it. I don't think that'll ever happen, and I don't think AI will ever be able to make human beings. I mean, we're flawed too, so even if they make something that's somewhat sentient, it's not going to have the same flaws or you know, properties of the mind that we have now. So I don't know. How do you think about that kind of stuff?
Yeah, those are really big questions and just extremely tricky to kind of, I don't know, try and tease apart, like, what, like, where is my thinking biased and where is it kind of being balanced? It's like really hard to know where I'm kind of injecting my biases into these kind of topics. But with the AI thing, I would agree, because whatever machine we create hasn't like the human body evolved over millions of years, and it's not embodied like we are, and it doesn't have these flaws that you point out.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, AI, trying to create a human clone using AI, it does depend on a certain assumption, which is kind of like the computational theory of mind. So we can do it if the human mind does work like a computer. But again, that's something we don't really know, and I think you can definitely question that assumption. I don't think the human mind does operate like any computer we know, so I'm not really sure about that argument. Yeah, that's kind of just my take
on
it.
Yeah, I just think it's weird though. Like, we're able to work on other human beings. There's people that, you know, they'll take their brain out of their head after they're dead and they'll look at it and study it. We have scientists trying to figure out, you know, what's going on. But like I said, I think there's something about being able to get outside of yourself or your consciousness. We can't put ourselves in other people's consciousness, and we can't take ourselves out of our own consciousness. The closest we can get is like altered states. So I think that's the big thing. I don't know. That's just my take. And I don't think that science is as close to creating an AI that's, again, you can create something that's maybe passed even the Turing test, but to have those human-like properties or qualities is a completely different story, in my opinion. So,
yeah, that's a really good point about not being able to see consciousness from an outside point of view. I mean, that is always going to be impossible. It would be like trying to look at your own eyes with your eyes. You just can't do it. Like, the thing you're looking at it through the thing you want to look at. So there's always going to be this barrier. You can never be an objective observer. But like you say, with psychedelics, you can at least alter your perspective. So you can't, I mean, some people might say you can go outside your consciousness, but at least from my thinking, with psychedelics, you can at least get a different angle or vantage point, which can be really useful, at least for better understanding consciousness.
For sure.
Yeah.
Well, let's wrap it up here. We're going to do a short Patreon segment with you, but this has been super fun. I do want to get you back on in the future. And
yeah, absolutely.
There's a million things we could talk about. I just felt like that was a good intro, given, you know, what I've read of your work so far, and the topics that we're both interested in and everything like that. So, but everybody go check out Sam's website. It's samwolf.com. I have the link all the way down at the bottom if you want to read all of his articles. Is there somewhere you write consistently, or is it just kind of sporadic, whatever kind of happens?
I would say just on my website. I try and post once a week if I can. That's pretty much where you can find all my work.
Sure.
Beautiful. Right, well,
go check that out. He's also active on Twitter. So find him on Twitter. What do you know your handle on Twitter?
Yeah, it's at Sam Wolf. Wolf is spelled W-O-O-L-F-E.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So go follow him on there. And yeah. If you are interested, we are about to do the Patreon segment. I will upload it later. So if you want to check that out, head on over to patreon.com/mindescapepodcast for just $2 a month. You'll get exclusive guest episodes and segments, which we are about to do. We have other tiers on there too, if you want to check it out. We're also on Discord. We do have a new merch store that's up. I have some awesome designs. I just created one with Anubis. And what else do we have on there? I created a composite image of the Portara at Naxos, so go check that out. There's some really cool stuff on there. And let's not forget our favorite t-shirt, Let Maury Speak, or hashtag Let Maury Speak. So go check that out. I promise I'm not making him not speak. He speaks as much as he wants to, but sometimes the guy just doesn't have much to say. What can I say? Head on over to indrasweb.org. It is live. This is a social media platform we created to connect open minds. And one more thing. Again, if you're interested in winning this MindEscape t-shirt, we do have a large and a medium left. So that's something that will fit you and you're interested. You can enter to win this t-shirt. Head on over to Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star review, and take a screenshot of it, send it to mindescapepodcast@gmail.com. That will enter you in. Congratulations to Cole, who won last month's t-shirt, and we had a runner-up of Abner. So thank you so much for your support. Again, thank you for everybody for the kind messages, and shout out to Sandy, and shout out to Ryan, shout out to everybody that was in the live stream today. We love everybody. Stay safe out there, and we'll catch you next time. Peace.
Peace.
See ya.